Good day, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast, listeners. This week, a conversation I've been looking forward to for quite a while. Mr. Charles Slack, author of Liberty's First Crisis, joins us on the show, and I can't recommend this book highly enough. I really enjoyed it, and as I said towards the end of the show, I can't imagine a Thomas Jefferson Hour listener who would not really enjoy this book, but it was a great conversation, great fun.
Well, he was so interesting, and, you know, it's something I want to do a lot more of. And I, by the way, to our 1776 Club listeners and others, if you think of people we should interview, people who are writing about Jefferson or writing about the founding era, people you know who bring an important perspective to this subject, this broad subject of Jefferson and his world.
Great perspective in this book.
So this was your idea, David. You had come upon Charles Slack's book before I did. I then ordered it. It's fascinating. You called him up. He was willing to do it, and it was a great interview. You know, he really, you can tell he loves history.
You know, one of the things we did not talk with him about, and that I wish we had, and I did some searching, and I should call him back, but he had all of these quotes from the Aurora and some of the other newspapers in Philadelphia.
So the Aurora was the anti-Federalist newspaper that was edited by the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, Benjamin Franklin Bache.
I did find one book and ordered it, but, you know, I
have the Aurora at home.
Are you serious?
I can bring you a loner copy.
Maybe I ordered the same thing.
Okay, it's about the Aurora. It's a thick book about the history of the Aurora.
Anyway, he went back and found all this stuff.
Well, it's all out there, but it's really interesting. And so Benjamin Franklin Bache was the grandson of the great Dr. Franklin, but he was an ardent anti-Federalist, pro-Jeffersonian, and kind of a bulldog. And didn't mind offending the Federalists. Then you have Matthew Lyon, the congressman from Vermont, who got into a famous blow.
Well, they'll hear about that
on
the podcast.
And then, of course, the notorious James Thompson Calendar. And, you know, I asked him the question of whether, I know this sounds like an irresponsible question, but Calendar drowned in 1803 in the James River in 3 feet of water.
Right.
Some part of me has always wondered, did he drown or was he drowned? It's probably irresponsible to think that way, but it happens. You know, who will rid me of this terrible nuisance? And then some Meriwether Lewis or somebody else takes it too seriously.
Oh my, a conspiracy.
This sort of thing happens, and I've always thought that a great historical novel, and you'd have to say novel, fiction, would be about Meriwether Lewis killing Calendar.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and I would not rule it out.
What you may have started. I think it's time we go to the show. We do want to thank you all very much for listening, and those of you who have chosen to support the show, thank you, thank you, thank you. We've got some fun reviews on last week's show, The Call-In Show. We're going to do more of that. Go to jeffersonhour.com or the Jefferson Hour Facebook page to learn more, or just keep listening. Thanks again. Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. And this week, we are so pleased to present a special conversation with the author Charles Slack about his latest book, Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. We have Mr. Slack on the line. And Charlie, I spoke to you last week, and you were so gracious and agreeable to come on the Thomas Jefferson Hour and discuss your book. And I must tell you, I just devoured this book. I enjoyed it so much. And I must say, you're an interesting fellow. You've written a number of books. In reading your bio, you're originally from Madison. You now live in Connecticut. And for a while, I think you lived in Virginia. And you're an ex-newspaper man as well. Am I getting all that correct?
You are, yes. I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, and now live in Connecticut. I grew up in the Boston area and have worked at newspapers in Tennessee and Virginia, so I have been around.
Thank you so much for being willing to be on our program.
It's my pleasure. I'm just really glad to be a part of this.
The book is just so interesting to me, and I know Clay has a lot of questions too, but can you give us just a short synopsis of what the book is about and why you wrote it?
Sure. Liberty's First Crisis talks about the Sedition Act of 1798, which was a tumultuous period in our history shortly after the founding when Congress passed and President Adams signed a law called the Sedition Act, making it illegal to criticize the government. I became interested in this. I think I've, as a writer and a journalist, always been deeply interested in free speech, and had always wondered how on earth such principled people could have passed a law like that just 7 years after passing the Bill of Rights. And I think that question had been in the back of my mind for years and years, and eventually it sort of rose to the top, and I started investigating. And the more I looked into it, the more interesting it became to me, and that was sort of a good indication that it might be a good subject for a book.
We're so glad to have you. This is Clay Jenkinson, and David Swenson is the host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. So when the alien and sedition laws were passed during the quasi-war crisis of 1798, Jefferson was flabbergasted, and he said later these were laws worthy of the 9th or 10th century. Can you provide some historical context about this?
Sure. The laws came about during a time when I think some striking similarities to our own, but there a lot of people felt that the country was in deep danger. The two superpowers of the day were England and France. The United States was still sort of a weak and new country and unsure of its own survival. The Federalists, who were in power, they sort of sided with the English, and the Democratic Republicans, of which Thomas Jefferson, as the vice president, was the sort of the leading member, favored France. And in this environment, the Federalists, who controlled most of the power, desperately believed that voices of opposition were harming the country. And so even though just 7 years had passed since the Bill of Rights had become law, I think the Bill of Rights is the most beautiful document ever put in place by a government. And, of course, the First Amendment saying that we have free speech, but they put in a law making it illegal to criticize government officials because they felt that it was making it hard for them to govern through this perilous time.
I want to go back to the specifics of the law and its enforcement here in a minute, but you know what you say about the French Revolution. So I think you're trying to make the best case you can for those who were in a reactive and even paranoid mood here in the United States. Is it true that Adams and people around him felt that we might be drawn into the vortex of this great cataclysm in France?
Absolutely. I think that most Americans, including Adams, when the French Revolution occurred, saw tremendous parallels between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. And a lot of Americans were proud. They felt, here's this old, established, powerful country, France, and they've been inspired by us to have their own revolution. But, of course, the French Revolution very quickly devolved into mobs in the streets and guillotines and heads rolling. And I think that the people in power in the United States saw that happening and thought, well, that's a hop, skip, and a jump on our own side of the Atlantic before we might see the same things happening here.
So they weren't just opportunistically using this international crisis as a way to create repressive laws for this country. They were actually deeply concerned that the nightmare of the French Revolution might eat our republic?
Absolutely. I mean, when I talk about the two models of England and France, I think that everybody wanted to maintain this liberty that we had established, this sort of tender, unsure liberty that we had just put into place in our country. And people saw the two principal dangers to our liberty were, one, through an overpowerful government that might clamp down, or second, through an unhinged mob that might sort of invoke mob rule and anarchy. And I think to the Federalists who were in power, they saw the what had happened in France after the French Revolution as an example of mob rule, and they feared that might happen. On the other side, you had the Democratic Republicans who saw England and this powerful monarchy and looked at the Federalists, Adams and Hamilton and others, as wanting to put in place a monarchy. So everybody wanted to protect liberty. They just couldn't agree on what the big dangers were.
I'd like to move back to the beginning a little bit, if we could. Charlie, when we talked last week for the first time, I was well into your book, Liberty's First Crisis. And I have to be careful here that I don't laud too much praise on you, or it'll sound like a pitch. But I really enjoyed your book.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome, sir. I enjoyed it because not only is it a great piece of work for as far as history, but it helped me do what I like to do, which is get inside these historical figures' heads. And it also sort of gave me some context for the times we're living in now. You write in chapter one, "The greatest enemy of liberty is fear. When people feel comfortable and well-protected, they are naturally expansive and tolerant of one another's opinions and rights. When they feel threatened, their tolerance shrinks. By 1798, the euphoria surrounding the American Revolution, the sense of a common purpose and a common enemy, was gone."
Yes, I mean, I think that during the revolutionary period, it was very easy for all Americans to look at England as the oppressive force occupying our land, telling us what to do, taxing us from afar. So it was very easy for everybody to sort of coalesce around this idea that we want liberty and we need to get rid of this this oppressive force. Well, once the war had been won and we were now putting in place our own government, suddenly we were faced with this idea of how do we govern ourselves, and how do we, now that the people passing these laws is us, how do we deal with resistance? How do we deal with people who don't like what the current government is putting into place? How do we tolerate people who are criticizing us when we're doing what we think is right for the country? In essence, we had passed these glorious words, and now we had to figure out how to live by them in a practical sense, and whether it even made sense to do so.
Well, you write that the sense of a common purpose and a common enemy was gone. In your book, there are three, what I would call three main characters that you talk about that are just fascinating. I believe the first one you talk about is Matthew Lyon. Could you sort of explain to our listeners who he was?
Sure. Matthew Lyon was one of my favorite characters in the book. He was a guy, he came over from Ireland at the age of about 14 as an indentured servant. And he came to Connecticut, which is the state where I live now, and as an indentured servant. And he, I think, found Connecticut even back then a bit too confining. It was a Federalist state and not much opportunity. So as soon as he'd worked off his indenture, he went up to Vermont, what was then pre-statehood, up to the wilds of Vermont, and fought in the Revolutionary War, and he built, after the Revolutionary War, a business empire. He was uneducated Irish immigrant, and ultimately got himself elected to Congress from Vermont shortly after Vermont became a state. Well, he was the opposite of a Federalist, and the Federalists who were in power were almost uniformly English-descended. They saw themselves as the preservers and the saviors of this new democracy, and they really felt that it was the place of people like Matthew Lyon to sort of know their place, to be laborers and not to inject themselves into the political conversation. And one of the fascinating things about Matthew Lyon was that he took those words about all men created equal and this idea of liberty for all seriously, and he felt that he had every right to be a part of the governing system. And so he got himself elected to Congress, and he immediately began loudly, vociferously criticizing John Adams, who was the Federalist president, and criticizing his fellow members of Congress. And he became this catalyst that really was one of the sort of key forces, key irritants, that put in place the Federalist anger and led them to pass this Sedition Act, making it illegal to criticize the government. And the irony, of course, was that Matthew Lyon was himself a member of the government, but yet became the first victim of the Sedition Act.
But he was also an immigrant, what they call the hordes of wild Irishmen. And that's what stuck out to me, is that there was this concern about undesirable immigrants coming to America.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point you make. And in fact, I've done some talks about the book where I sort of describe a situation going on in the country, and everybody laughs and nods their head because it sounds exactly like today. And then, of course, my punchline is everybody knows I'm talking about 1798, because we were really fighting over the same things. You can change some of the nationalities, but the quote that you said about hordes of wild Irishmen was a congressman from Massachusetts, Harry Gray Otis, who said, you know, we don't have anything against industrious, hardworking immigrants, but we can't have these hordes of wild Irishmen invading our shores. They really felt that the country was becoming too crowded and we needed to do something about immigration.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and we're speaking with the author Charles Slack about his latest book, Liberty's First Crisis. We need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment.
Hello everyone, this is Clay Jenkinson. I want to invite you to participate in this year's cultural tour on the Lewis and Clark Trail. It's our 12th time for me going up the Wendover Death March. This is the trip that never gets old. It's the highlight of my year. You'll see why when you come. 3 days on the wild and scenic White Cliffs area of the Missouri River, east of Fort Benton, and then 4 days up on the Lolo Trail, the most pristine part of the entire Lewis and Clark route that starts at Monticello and ends at the shores of the Pacific Ocean. This is my favorite of all the cultural tours. You can sign up. It's July 18th through 27th. You can find out details at Odyssey Tours or jeffersonhour.org. We want to see you on the trail, and I hope that you will take a look at this and other cultural tours. Thanks. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We're so pleased this week to be joined by the author Charles Slack, talking about his latest book, Liberty's First Crisis: Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. And when we took our break, we've been talking about one of those misfits, Congressman Matthew Lyon. Clay?
I want to come back to Matthew Lyon here in a minute and have you talk about his famous troubles on the floor of Congress with Roger Griswold. But let me go to this. So in 1791, the Bill of Rights is adopted, is ratified. And as you, I think, put it, the First Amendment is one of the most beautiful pieces of constitutional law ever created by any country, with its very strong guarantee of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. So the Adams administration, faced with this war scare, passes the sedition law. Tell us about the specifics of what the sedition law was attempting to do.
You're absolutely right. I mean, just a word on the Bill of Rights. I mean, and the First Amendment. The reason why I say that I believe it's the most beautiful document ever created by a government is because it sets about to limit its own power. Throughout history, every other government passes laws and makes pronouncements that essentially say, hand over your liberty to us and we'll take care of things for you. Here was a government at the very outset saying, here's what we can't do to mess with your life. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the irony with John Adams was that he, as a younger man, had been sort of the most eloquent, I think, among the founders in speaking out in the need for free speech and freedom of the press, particularly to be able to criticize those in power. But what happened was, during this period when Adams was president and he was feeling this threat that we might be about to go to war with France, and here were these journalists and opposition politicians on a daily basis calling him names, printing terrible things about him, making it very difficult for him to govern through this difficult time, that he essentially forgot his principles. He forgot those principles that he had stood up for. And so he approved this law that was passed by Congress that made it illegal to criticize members of the government and to bring them into disrepute. And I think what they were trying to do was to quell this criticism so that they could, to their minds, do their jobs more effectively.
Those provisions to discredit the government or to bring it into disrepute, they represent a pretty broad and vague brush. What sorts of crimes were prosecuted under the Sedition Act?
Well, under the Sedition Act, there were it was predominantly journalists, editors, and there were, Matthew Lyon was a member of Congress and was thrown in jail for things he said about John Adams on the campaign trail back in Vermont. And essentially, I mean, one of the great dangers of law like this is, as you said, it was vague, and it was about bringing members of Congress into disrepute. So essentially, anything that somebody felt made them look bad was potentially actionable.
I found it very interesting that many in the executive branch were exempt from prosecution, but not all. Can you talk about that?
What the law specifically mentioned, that you can't criticize or you can't bring into disrepute the president and members of Congress. And very interesting that they did not mention the vice president. And the reason for that is that in those days, of course, there were not official political parties. And so the first person, the candidate who got the most votes running for president became president. In this case, it was John Adams. The person who came in second place, in this case, Thomas Jefferson, became the vice president. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson was a member of the opposition, this informal party called the Democratic Republicans or the Republicans, and the Federalists didn't particularly care about protecting his rights, so they left Vice President off of that list.
He could have actually been prosecuted under the Sedition Act then.
Well, not only could he have been prosecuted under the Sedition Act, but it was not specifically a crime to criticize him.
When we look at these prosecutions today, they seem pitiful and even laughable. A liberty pole, or somebody calling John Adams a hermaphrodite, or saying he's wholly unfit for the presidency. What do you make of all of that? The things that today wouldn't even rise to the level of public notice were regarded as sedition in this moment. How can we take that seriously?
Well, I think it's heartening in one sense that we've sort of come to the point that nobody would consider Donald Trump trying to throw somebody in jail for criticizing him, or Barack Obama a few months ago doing the same. Certainly, there's all that criticism goes by unpunished, and rightfully so. But I think that we've got to be on guard. I think that every generation sort of faces its own issues, and I think the principle is that we've always got to be on guard. I mean, one thing that doesn't change is that people don't like to be criticized, and they don't like to have the things that they hold sacred criticized, and that sort of has maintained steady throughout our history.
But in the face of this international crisis and domestic crisis, Jefferson maintained his usual serenity and said that these were abuses that not only violated the rights of man and the First Amendment, but they weren't even fundamentally serious enough to discredit the Federalists and the Adams administration. Give us a sense of Jefferson's response to this.
It's a great question, and Jefferson was to my mind, and you're clearly an expert on Jefferson beyond me, but to my mind, a very canny politician, in addition to being a great thinker. And he was always very careful about being at the forefront of these controversies. Unlike Matthew Lyon, who always led with his chin and got thrown in jail, Jefferson was a bit more circumspect, particularly in the early going on the Sedition Act. He clearly thought that it was a violation of constitutional principles. He sort of on the quiet bankrolled some opposition journalists like James Thompson Callender and others. And ultimately, as he became more and more alarmed, he wrote with Madison the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which essentially called into question whether states should stay in the Union if the federal government passes laws of this nature. So he was sort of working behind the scenes, and as he became more and more alarmed about the law, he took greater and greater action.
You're a little hard on our man Jefferson. You write, of all the politicians of the era, it was Jefferson who mastered the sly art of quietly supporting writers and editors to promote his views and discredit his enemies and their policies. In personal encounters, Jefferson remained polite and carefully non-confrontational.
As I say, one of the most fascinating relationships that I researched in my book was the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and this journalist, James Thompson Callender. And Callender was an immigrant from Scotland and a sort of a rogue character who just didn't like anybody who was in power. He was sort of the eternal opposition journalist. He was kind of a dangerous character in a way. He was an alcoholic. He was just in one scrape after another, and he went after Hamilton. He went after Adams. And during that period, Jefferson was slipping him $50 here, $50 there, praising him and helping to sort of keep Callender's publications going. But he did that quietly. And, you know, I don't know whether that's a criticism or not, but he, as I say, I think he was a survivor and a good politician in that sense, because Callender was a self-destructive guy who, you know, wound up drowning in a drunken fit in the James River. And that's where sort of at the opposite end of the scale from Jefferson, what happened to some of these characters.
Another character that you write about in the book that I found fascinating was Benjamin Franklin Bache.
Benjamin Franklin Bache was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, and Franklin had taken him over when he was a young boy over to his mission and his diplomatic mission in France, and Bache had sort of soaked up this love of France and this love of his father's principles and ideas of liberty. And when Franklin died, he bequeathed to his grandson Bache all of his printing equipment, which must have seemed like a great gift, but ultimately sealed his fate, because Bache started a newspaper called the Aurora, which began criticizing powerful people in the United States. First, George Washington as president, and then John Adams. And ultimately, his criticisms of Adams led to his being arrested, and he was about to go on trial for sedition, and he contracted yellow fever during the summer of 1798 and died quite literally at his press defending his freedoms at the age of 29.
So if a dozen or so people were prosecuted and jailed and also fined, sometimes very substantial amounts, how did this all come out? There was some sunset provision in these laws, wasn't there?
There was. It's a great question. People sort of wonder what became of the Sedition Act. And the Federalists who passed it were very canny in the sense of not wanting it to be turned on them. So they created the law so that it would sort of sunset with the election of 1800. And I think their idea was that if they lost the election, it would make it that much harder for people who won to turn the law on them. And if they won the election, they could just reinstate it.
So Jefferson wins the election. The sedition law is no more, but there are still people languishing in prison. What did Jefferson do?
Well, Jefferson exonerated anybody who was, I think there were a couple of people, if I'm remembering correctly, David Brown, one of the most fascinating characters, this sort of wandering misanthrope who'd been the longest jailed of any of the defendants for putting up anti-Adams signs in Massachusetts. He was let out of prison at last. And then James Thompson Callender, who had been a close associate of Jefferson's over the years, was in a prison cell in Richmond, Virginia, and he was let out of jail. And I think with Jefferson, his first inaugural address, it's one of those founding documents or founding era documents that I don't think gets quite enough attention. It's just one of the most beautiful political addresses that I've ever read. And in that, he took the crucial step when he was inaugurated of famously saying, "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists." And what he meant by that was not, "We all have to get along." It was his way of acknowledging that this country has to absorb opposing opinions, that we have to have people who very strongly disagree with one another, and we have to learn to live with that. And he very eloquently, and you know, you talk about parallels to our own time, he even said in there that if somebody goes so far as to say that they want to destroy the United States, if we let that person have their say, we are actually declaring ourselves to be a stronger country. Because if we act in fear and throw somebody in jail for saying that, that's a symbol of our weakness, not of our strength. And I think that is just, it's just one of the most beautiful speeches I've ever read.
Agreed. So let's just follow this out for a minute. So Jefferson's now president. He releases those who are still in prison, and he remits their fines. What went wrong with the calendar situation?
Calendar, when he gets out of jail in Richmond, he believes that he's suffered for the cause and that it's time for him to get some due. So he feels like he's in line for some sort of a position within the Thomas Jefferson administration. Now, Jefferson, I mentioned before, was a canny politician, and I think at that point recognized that Calendar had been very useful when Jefferson was a member of the opposition, but now that you're president of the United States, you don't need this unhinged, uncontrollable alcoholic serving in your administration. So when Calendar came up to the Capitol looking for a position, James Madison met with Calendar and passed along from Jefferson another $50 and very gently, there's going to be no cabinet position or any official post. I think Calendar may have wanted to be postmaster of Richmond. So Calendar goes back brooding all the way back to Richmond, and he starts an opposition newspaper now opposing Thomas Jefferson and becomes an ardent Federalist and begins criticizing Jefferson on a daily basis. And ultimately, he's the journalist that first publishes the news or of Sally Hemings, who was the slave that Jefferson was alleged to have had an ongoing affair with and a number of children with.
Let me add a little bit here. So Calendar makes it clear that he wants a political payoff of some sort. He also feels that the fine was not remitted on a timely basis. He then begins to press the Jefferson administration. When he gets no relief, he says that he has information that could discredit, that could blackmail Jefferson. Even Meriwether Lewis gets involved for a time in all of this. Calendar then breaks the John Walker story that Jefferson, as a young man, attempted to seduce his neighbor's wife. Jefferson later admits that that's true. And he, in 1802, in September of 1802, Calendar breaks the Sally Hemings story, which had been brooded about locally but had not had any national play. And that story has dogged Jefferson ever since and is now regarded as essentially a proved allegation. After all of this, Calendar dies. He drowns in what appears to be maybe a suicide or a severe drinking bout. You know, every time I've looked at that, Charlie, I've had to wonder in some part of my mind whether one of Jefferson's, I'm using the word friends in quotation marks, helped Calendar drown. Do you have any sense of this?
You know, that is a speculation that has sort of been out there almost from the time it happened. And I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, but in some senses, you know, Calendar was such a self-destructive character that he was headed that way regardless. And I just, I think I can't remember off the top of my head, there were opposite journalists who had been former compatriots of Calendar's who were now in daily opposition to Calendar, and they sort of suggested that maybe Calendar had committed suicide. I don't know. It's just impossible to know. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, but my guess is that Callender got drunk and went down to bathe in the river and drowned.
Well, it was certainly convenient. Just to wrap that up, I mean, Abigail Adams in 1804 famously said to Jefferson, the serpent that you cherished, you know, by encouraging Callender, you essentially unloosed a monster, and he came back to bite you, and congratulations, you got exactly what you deserved. She essentially said there's karma out there,
yeah,
and you've now gotten what you reserve, sir. But you know, probably nobody in the history of the United States damaged Thomas Jefferson more than James Thompson Callender.
Yeah, and he did the same thing to Alexander Hamilton, who was Jefferson's enemy, by putting out the Mariah Reynolds story, which was Hamilton's affair. On the other hand, you quoted that letter from Abigail to Thomas Jefferson, and the free speech advocate, to my mind, sees it in the opposite light that she sees it in. I mean, she sees it in, isn't it unfortunate that Callender was able to say these things because you enabled him? And my opinion is that, you know, it's a good thing we have our James Thompson Callenders.
Here's David.
Oh my, now that's a discussion that could go on and on and on. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We're so pleased this week to be joined by the author Charles Slack, talking about his book, Liberty's First Crisis. And we'll return to that discussion in just a moment. Back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We're so pleased this week to have the author Charles Slack join us, talking about his book Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech. And there are some very entertaining stories in the book about those misfits.
So let's have a little fun for a moment. Describe the fight, or fights rather, between Griswold and Lyon.
That's a great story. So Matthew Lyon had gotten himself elected to Congress, and he was this lightning rod in Congress in Philadelphia. He began immediately criticizing John Adams, refusing to attend the pageantry where the members of Congress would parade to hear, to deliver their response to Adams at his home, and all of these things. And the Federalists just hated his presence. They couldn't abide this uneducated Irish former indentured servant sitting among them in their august lawmaking body. And there had been a rumor about Matthew Lyon during his Revolutionary War days that as a commander, he and his troops had run away from a battle, and he had been forced to wear a wooden sword in commemoration of his cowardice. And so that apocryphal story followed Matthew Lyon around for his whole life. And he was on the floor of Congress one day, and Roger Griswold, who was a representative from Connecticut, called out to him, "If you go to Connecticut, you better wear your wooden sword." And Matthew Lyon turned and spit in Roger Griswold's face. And it set off this just amazing period in Congress, consumed by this spitting incident. And the Federalists tried to have Matthew Lyon thrown out. They spent 2 weeks, if you go through the annals of Congress, it's amazing, all of the things going on in the world, 2 solid weeks talking about a gob of saliva and what the situation was when Lyon spit on Griswold. And after a few weeks, Congress was unable to have Lyon evicted They didn't muster sufficient votes, so Griswold took matters into his own hands. He showed up at Congress one day carrying a stout walking stick and started beating Matthew Lyon over the head. Matthew Lyon grabbed a pair of fire tongs from the fireplace and retaliated, and the two were going at it on the floor of Congress until they were ultimately separated and moved out into the outer area where they kept the fight going. It was just phenomenal. I always cite that when people tell me that we need to return to the days of civility in the Capitol.
Here's our democracy. So Lyon is then prosecuted successfully under the sedition law, goes to jail, from which he's reelected.
Yes, it's one of the greatest stories, I think, in congressional history, where you have a guy, he was not arrested in relation to the spitting incident. He had gone back to Vermont to campaign for reelection, was criticizing John Adams heavily and quoted a speech saying that John Adams belonged in a madhouse and so forth. So in that fall, while he was still campaigning, he was arrested and charged with sedition. And he was sort of put through a kangaroo court and sentenced to 4 months in prison in Vermont. He was thrown into a drafty jail cell in the town of Vergennes, Vermont, which is a little south of Burlington. And he sat there and became a model prisoner. I think the Federalists had been hoping that he would act in a crazy manner and escape and destroy himself. But instead, he became a model prisoner and was ultimately reelected to his congressional seat from prison, and got out of prison and got in a carriage and headed down to the Capitol in Philadelphia. And it's not only a wonderful story, but it's also very instructive for what happens when people pass laws like the Sedition Act intending to do one thing, which is to shut up their enemies, and what they actually do is create martyrs. Because Matthew Lyon had been quite a controversial and in many ways unpopular figure. But as he sat in jail, unjustly thrown in jail for criticizing his fellow politicians, he became more and more of a martyr and a hero, and that's the way he was greeted when he returned to Philadelphia.
Just have time for a few more questions, Charlie. One is from your title, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits, who save free speech. I take it your point is that when we think about the First Amendment, we sort of imagine people using Ciceronian rhetoric and high-minded criticisms of the opposition and so on. And it turns out that it's a lot messier than that. And the voices that have protected the First Amendment have often been people that you might not want to be in close association with, but they do a service to this country.
Just said it absolutely perfectly. Questions of free speech never revolve around Betty Crocker's right to publish the latest brownie recipe. That's just not what happens. It's always somebody who's setting out to deliberately provoke and to make people in power angry. And so you're right. It's often people, it's misfits. Almost by definition, they don't fit into the pervading power structure. The real danger, I think, with free speech is not those people, those misfits who are saying bad things about us. The problem is that when we're in power and somebody is saying horrible things, we don't think that it is destroying freedom to shut that person up because they're crazy, they're saying awful things, they're racist, they're homophobes, they're whatever. So that's the real danger, is not so much the forces from outside saying the terrible things, it's the reaction that that provokes in us to forget our principles and shut them down and destroy our own freedoms in the process.
I want to go to astonishment for another minute, Charlie. I mean, if Jefferson and Madison and Adams and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin could see our discourse, the kind of savage innuendos of our system or pornography as it is proliferating through the United States, or people putting recipes for making drugs at home or creating incendiary weapons and so on, I think that their astonishment at the breadth of the protections of the First Amendment would nearly make them faint, don't you?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I'm not sure that, I don't think that they would be in favor of curtailing. I think, I come back to Jefferson's inaugural address where he says, you know, the more we tolerate opinions we hate, the stronger we are. And I think that this temptation, I think that they would recognize, you know, the internet, of course, has changed things in a lot of ways. But I, one of the things that I point out at, in the end of my book is that with every new technology, we always consider ourselves to be on the precipice of disaster. And how many times you can go throughout history and people say, well, the founders had a great idea, but they never envisioned X, Y, or Z. You know, and they said it about television, and they said it about radio, and so forth, and now it's the internet. Well, the founders loved free speech, but they never envisioned the internet. Well, you know what? Technology is going to continue to change, but to my mind, that's only stronger reason why we have to hold fast to these principles, even as technology changes, and not sort of readapt our principles to every change in technology.
I'm glad we've kept this in a historical frame, concentrating on the founding generation. But let me ask you one question about where we are today. As we record this interview, Donald Trump has been president for about 5 weeks. He's already said that the press are enemies to America, and he has discredited their capacity for even providing the basis of factual information about what's going on in the United States and in his administration. Is that the typical antagonism between the executive and the press, or are we in some kind of dangerous ground here?
I think if you go back to 1798, I think the astonishing thing is the parallels. I see so many parallels. In some ways, to me, there are more parallels between the environment we are in right now and 1798 than the environment we're in right now and, say, 1950. It's sort of no holds barred, and you know, with between tweeting and blogging, and everybody's got a voice, and it's chaotic, and in that sense, I think the press sort of resembles, or the media sort of resemble the 1798, when there was a lot more advocacy journalism, and everybody was sort of having their say. In terms of whether Trump and his opposition to the press represents a danger, I don't think so yet. I mean, the thing that would alarm me about Trump from a free speech perspective would be if he tried to take some kind of action to actively shut down a newspaper. But I don't see anything that he has said so far as being a direct threat to the First Amendment, though I know a lot of people have suggested that.
Towards the end of the book, Charlie, you talk about the 220 years after the adoption of the Bill of Rights, and you say in Madison's gloomier moments, he wondered if these parchment barriers would stand up. How do you feel about that? What do you think they would think today, were they able to look at the situation we have now?
I can't think that the founders, that Madison and others could look at today and be anything but incredibly gratified and astonished that the system and the documents that they put in place would continue to exist as and to have the strength and power that they do to this day. And I think they would be astonished as well that we're often fighting over the exact same things. These issues are never black and white, and they're highly complex, and we're fighting over them to this very day. But I can't help but think that they would be anything but just astonished and pleased that these documents continue to sort of shape our thinking.
Well, Mr. Slack, I thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Hour this week. You were so gracious when I called you, and I told you that I couldn't imagine a listener to the Jefferson Hour who would not enjoy this book. And I also told you that for the chaotic times we seem to be living in, reading this book in some way gave me faith, sort of calmed me down.
I think that you said it perfectly. It has been a lot of a tremendous solace to me to have had the journey of investigating and researching the chaotic environment of 1798 because I saw that they got through it. They, too, felt that they were at the edge of the cliff, and they somehow persevered. And so I know we will, too, and I have such faith in this country. And in the ultimately, you know, we have a lot of chaos and a lot of chaotic thinking and a lot of a disagreement. But one of the heartening things about Americans is that ultimately I think we make the right decisions, and we recognize injustice, and we recognize threats to our liberty, and we don't tolerate them for too long. And so I have to think that we will do the same regardless of what happens to us in the future. So I remain optimistic.
I have to say the icon on the front of your book, the design, shows John Adams looking in one direction and our man Jefferson looking in the other. And I see that Jefferson has a gag order of none other than the flag of the United States. I think Jefferson would not be happy with that.
You'll have to talk to the designer.
We've been talking to Charles Slack, the author of Liberty's First Crisis, Adams, Jefferson, and the Misfits Who Saved Free Speech, 2015. Good luck with your writing, and we'll look forward to our next encounter with you, sir.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
And now it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Thank you, David. I spent President's Day thinking about the best and worst presidents in American history. I don't put Mr. Jefferson in the top five of our greatest presidents, maybe not even in the top 10. However, he was, I feel, the greatest man who ever became president of the United States. He's America's Leonardo da Vinci. But he did not particularly want to be president, and he had a decidedly understated two-term tenure between 1801 and 1809. Jefferson's goal as president was to reduce the size of the national government, to reduce the size of the Army and Navy, to restore power to state authorities, and to reduce the national debt as severely as possible. He would have liked to create what he called internal improvements, a national museum and a national university, but he refused to spend money the nation didn't yet have, and he believed that even such desirable projects must be pre-authorized by constitutional amendments. This is hardly a formula for presidential greatness. As an ardent believer in a republican form of government, Jefferson distrusted the idea of a strong national executive. He believed in legislative supremacy. The people of America were sovereign, and the branch of the national government closest to the people was the legislative branch, particularly the House of Representatives. 100 years later, Theodore Roosevelt believed in taking all the authority granted to the president by the Constitution and as much more as he could get away with. Jefferson, by contrast, was an executive minimalist. Still, Mr. Jefferson had the good sense to accept Napoleon's offer of the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, perhaps the making moment of America's transcontinental destiny, and he sent the Lewis and Clark expedition out to take an inventory of the Great Plains and the American West. In my view, the greatest presidents in American history were men Jefferson would not have approved of. Lincoln, who held the Union together with armed force and freed slaves by executive order. Theodore Roosevelt, the first modern president, who brought the American people into the 20th century and the world arena sometimes kicking and screaming. FDR, who created the welfare state. Jefferson's list of greatest presidents would have included George Washington, whom he revered even though he believed that the father of our country stayed on the national stage about 4 years too long, and James Madison, his protege and collaborator, who pursued a faithful adaptation of Jefferson's idealistic principles and helped the master establish what is known as the Virginia Dynasty, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, that governed America for a quarter century and meanwhile created the world-class University of Virginia to boot. One of my old history professors, David Noble of the University of Minnesota, used to say that in the American pantheon, George Washington is God the Father, Abraham Lincoln is God the Son, and Thomas Jefferson is the Holy Spirit. That is a great insight. Jefferson is the author of American exceptionalism. He is the author of the American Dream, although my dream house does not quite rise to the whimsical grandeur of Monticello. He gave us our wall of separation between church and state. He provided the greatest expressions we have of freedom of the press and what he called, quote, the illimitable freedom of the human mind. He made the Library of Congress a universal rather than a narrow law library. He designed the template for secular higher education in the United States on orderly campuses, his academical village in Charlottesville, and he inaugurated the classical style for our most important public buildings, beginning with the state capitol in Richmond, Virginia. Most of this was done when Jefferson was not the President of the United States. I repeat, Jefferson was the greatest man who was ever president, and our debt to him is truly incalculable. And yet, if one person had to come off of Mount Rushmore, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, or Theodore Roosevelt, the one to scrape away would be Jefferson. He was too modest for that sort of monumentalism, and he loved nature too much to deface it with heroic sculpture. Besides, he wanted America to celebrate its people, not create a pantheon of secular saints who look down on us from the Empyrean. I'm Clay Jenkinson. Join us next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.